Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Prunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvi Navaditamastu Ma Vishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Is that song? Anybody have anything on their mind? I had something on my mind for the meditation, but I couldn't figure out how to do it.
What was it?
I'll talk about it maybe. I can talk about it. In the Mundaka Upanishad, there's one verse that talks about two avyaktas. The word avyakta means unmanifest. But vyakta means like a form. You know? Avyakta means without any form, so that's what we mean by unmanifest. And so there are two levels of avyakta. There's the parama avyakta, which is Brahman, which is this non-dual conscious being. And then the avyakta of maya, you know, depends upon Brahman for its being. The Brahman is always avyakta, in the sense that Brahman never changes to become anything. There's never a process of modification or becoming. So Brahman doesn't modify to become the creation, whereas Prakriti or the Maya does modify to become the creation, and it goes from manifest condition to unmanifest to manifest to unmanifest from beginningless time. It has no beginning. That's just the nature of creation. We call creation is the nature of Maya itself. And Maya has no independent being apart from Brahman. So Brahman is its being, and Maya depends upon it. Brahman is the what we call the Adhishtana, the very basis, the very truth of the Maya. It's the Satchit, the conscious being, which Maya, even if you just think of it in terms of existence, it's the very isness or existence that the Maya enjoys. It has no being, a separate being of its own. But so yourself is never, it is always unmanifest, but only unmanifest in the sense that it never modifies into nama-rupa, into name and form. It's not that it's in an unmanifest condition and then will become into a manifest condition. So in that sense, it's always manifest as it is. But vyakta implies form, so avyakta. So Brahman, as just your being, the conscious being that you are, is absolutely changeless. There's no duality. It has no parts to go from manifest, from unmanifest to manifest and back into unmanifest. Manifest. So, in a sense, Brahman never withdraws. There's never a withdrawal of consciousness. Consciousness, the Satchit, is always awake, even though there's no one to be awake there. Is it conscious that when we say that, sometimes Swamiji will tongue-in-cheek say that the self is always awake, it never goes to sleep, because the conscious being is always conscious being. So it doesn't withdraw into any type of a unmanifest condition to be not conscious. So that's the parama. Parama means the avyakta that is free of any type of limitation. When you say parama, sometimes it's defined as supreme or the greatest or something like that, but We sometimes, to talk about what we mean by parama, we say desha kala vastu aparicheda. That means aparicheda, it's never limited or circumscribed by time, space, or objectivity. It's absolutely free of that. Right? And so there's absolutely no becoming for Brahman, for consciousness. And so consciousness doesn't go through any type of process whatsoever. Whereas Maya does. Maya is comprised of sattva, rajas, and tamas, so it has three threads that are always interacting with each other. It is not non-dual, right? But it can go into an unmanifest condition, which all that means, unmanifest condition, all that means is that The Nama Rupa, names and forms that it is responsible for projecting, can be in an unmanifest condition, means the names and forms are withdrawn into a causal condition. So that causal condition of the manifestation of the creation is what we call avyakta. It's the causal condition of name and form. Right? So that's why we can say this creation is cyclical. Or for the creation, they look from the Vedic point of view, the creation is something which is beginningless and cyclical, so the whole creation comes into manifestation. Means that the namarupa, the names and forms, the interconnectedness of the whole thing, this manifestation of duality comes into manifestation, and then it goes into unmanifest condition on a total level, whereas for you as an individual, your deep sleep, the deep sleep, the waking, dreaming, deep sleep cycle is a cycle of manifest, unmanifest. So there's a cycle where it just through your 24-hour period, say you're in the waking state. Waking state means that the whole upadi, the body, mind, sense organs, the whole jiva upadi, right, is being experienced because your sense organs are operational. Your experience, because through your sense organs, you experience the nama rupas, the names and forms that can be objectified by sense perception, which include this physical body, you know, and includes all the names and forms that you see through your sense. Let me put it this way. The waking state includes everything that you can experience through your sense perception, including the physical body. Mm-hmm. Because we don't usually realize that the physical body is known to us through sense perception. To realize that, you have to. We do an exercise where you kind of mentally eliminate one sense organ at a time. You know, and then you realize, well, your experience of the physical body is really through sensory perception, including the sense of touch. You know, so you eliminate one at a time, and this physical world that we call the waking state goes away. But also, the physical body that is part of the waking state is not experienced. Okay. And then we have also on a subtle level, the subtle body that also goes into, can also go into unmanifest condition, or there can be the level of the physical body, the sense organs being withdrawn from the physical body, right? And yet the mind is still awake. The mind is subtle. The sense organs are subtle too, but the sense organs can be using your physical, the physical organs, you know, in order to perceive the world. Or when you go to sleep and into a dream state, usually you actually go into a deep sleep state and then into the dream state, but nevertheless, you go into a dream state, the sense organs and the mind are not awake to the physical body to use it for the perception of the waking state. And yet, the mind is awake. Right? So that you're able to then have a subtle reality that we call a dream. And now, so you're not awake, that the physical world becomes unmanifest, the nama rupas of the physical world are not being experienced, but the dream world is being experienced. So, in fact, the dream we're talking about, your experience of the dream world, were that included in that is any type of imagination, you know, daydream, any activity of the mind that is not connected to the sensory perception. The only thing that's awake is the mind. The sensory world is not being experienced at that time. So that's what we call the dream state, and it extends to any mental state which is not generated by sensory perception. Okay? So what comes to mind is like daydream and dream and things like that. This fantasy, imagination, that type of thing, where there's no contact with the physical world. But that also can go into unmanifest condition, and then when both the waking state and the dream state, those nama-rupas, those names and forms are not being perceived, they're unmanifest, because it's not like they're not there. They're not experienced because they are in unmanifest condition. But the same mind comes out. The same sense organs come out. The same identification with this body comes out of unmanifest condition. So what goes into unmanifest condition another way of saying it, what's going into unmanifest condition is not going into a state of destruction or non-existence. It's going into its causal condition from which it comes out. Okay? That causal condition is also, for the Maya, what we call avyakta, unmanifest, because there is no nama rupa, no name and form manifest at that time. So we look at, and maybe start seeing why I couldn't figure out how to do this in a guided meditation. But anyway, it's kind of important, so I just want to run it by you a little bit. So because of this, we have Maya and we have Brahman. Both are avyakta. Okay? These are two upadana karanas. Upadana karana means upadana is material cause. There are two material causes here. The material cause is just like, I can give you two examples of two types of material cause. The clay pot, for instance, right? The clay is the material cause of the pot, right? But that's very good for understanding satya mitya in terms of the relationship of the pot to the clay. We use it in that way. But also the pot material, we can say, has been manipulated by the pot maker to be put in the form of a pot. So that's using that illustration a little bit differently. We're taking the material. The material is modified, changed around, you can say, molded, constructed by the pot maker to become a pot. So another way of saying that, to make it more true to what we're trying to say here, is say if the clay is initially in like a blob, just a blob of clay, okay? There's no nama rupa really associated with it, let's pretend. It's just a blob. And then this blob manifests into something, like a pot or a plate or a tumbler. You know, it manifests into something. And so the prakriti there is going through some modifications to become something else. Even though the prakriti material, the clay, is still there, it's changing to become the pot. So that's one type of upadana karana, where the material itself actually goes through modification to become something. So when we say that Maya is like that, from its unmanifest condition, it goes through a process of change to become something. And so the words we've got upadana, the material karana, the material cause, upadana karana. But we say that Maya, that is responsible for this manifestation of all these nama-rupas, names and forms, in the form of this whole creation on a subtle level and physical level, just everything that exists within time and space, we say it's the parinama upadana karana. Parinama means it modifies. The material cause goes through a process of modification to manifest as this creation on subtle and physical level. All time, space, everything that exists within the creation, all of the lokas, everything that exists within time and space, is a modification of the prakriti, of the maya. So parinama means modification. So upadana karana is the material cause, which itself goes through modification. So we say maya is the material cause of this creation. It goes through the modifications to become the creation, and cyclically goes back into its own unmanifest condition. Right? And we can talk about how it does that and all that, but just in broad strokes, that's what's said. Okay? Brahman is also the material cause, upadana karana. So we have Maya as upadana karana, and we have Brahman as upadana karana, the material cause. But the difference with Brahman is that it's vivarta upadana karana. Vivarta means it goes through no modification whatsoever. It has done nothing. It has gone through no process of change at all to become the material cause of the creation. It just simply is what is here in actuality. So vivarta means that which goes through no modification to become the creation. So we say nothing is ever, you have not, the self does nothing to become the creation. It always is exactly the same way. that's for that to be, right, and to say it's still the material cause, then we have to go to, if it's the material cause, because once you say cause, with cause, then you think of effect, right? Karana, cause, and karya is the effect. So if Brahman goes through no modification or no change, how can there be any kind of cause-effect relationship, because the cause is the effect, and yet it's gone through no change at all. So nothing has happened for the cause to be the effect, or for even to call the cause a cause, because it's done nothing to cause anything, right? So you can't call it a cause even. And so what happens is, with this particular prakriya, this is an actual prakriya, it's a teaching methodology, what you end up recognizing is that what we would call an effect, something as an effect, is actually mithya. What mithya, when we label something as mithya, we're acknowledging that it is there. But we're saying that it has no being apart from Brahman. Brahman has never changed in any way. And what is mithya, you know, only has that same Brahman for its being. And we say that Brahman is the material cause, even though it's gone through no change at all, because mithya has no other being. Now if I go back to the clay pot and use this in another way, if we say that the clay is the material cause of the pot, that's a problem, because nothing has happened to the clay. In reference to the pot, there is no clay. I mean, in reference to the clay, there is no pot. There is only clay. Where's the pot? Just you have to put yourself, be the clay. Now, where is the pot? Right? Because there's nothing there but clay, you know? And the clay hasn't gone through any kind of modification to lose its clayness to become the pot.
Yeah.
Or then we shift over to the rope snake. What has the rope done to become the snake? If the rope is mistaken for a snake, what process has it gone through to become the snake? What has it done? How has it created the snake? You know, for the rope snake is an example. It's not actually used in the Upanishads. It's used in some of the Prakarana Granthas, the explanatory texts, because it has its own power. You know, from the standpoint of the rope, then you can ask, what has the rope done? It has nothing to do with it. It has nothing to do with the snake. The snake can only be, the snake has got to just be a product of Maya and can only be appreciated on the level of Maya, because from the standpoint of rope, there's no one doing anything to produce the snake. And so in that way, this rope snake example can become really useful, because you ask, well, how did Brahman create the creation? How did Brahman make all this happen? You say, Brahman yourself has never done anything to make this creation happen, because it's non-dual. Then another problem comes up, well, yeah, but this, I'm aware of this creation, this is my creation. You can start talking, have these kind of thoughts. Well, I'm aware of this creation, Brahman is awareness after all. This is a major stumbling block also. Brahman, you can hear me, Brahman is always awake. And we have a problem with that, because we think of Brahman as a knower. Brahman is always awake. Brahman is always awake only as consciousness, not as consciousness of something. For it to be conscious of something, it needs to have some sort of an instrument to allow for a seer-seen relationship, or hear-heard relationship, or thinker-thought relationship. That all requires Maya, that all requires duality, that all requires having a mind or sense organs or a buddhi and all of these type of things. But all of these your instruments of knowledge all exist within Maya, right? Within the creation, within time and space. So Brahman doesn't have any eyes or ears. He doesn't have any thoughts or feelings or emotions. Brahman is just me. Pure, simple me. It's all not, also it doesn't work to say Brahman is, you know, non-dual conscious being. Because then you think, non-dual conscious being, what does that have to do with me? These are words that just, these words just take Brahman away from you. Who wants to be non-dual conscious being? What the heck does that mean? Does it mean anything? The words non-dual conscious being, you have to recognize as your own nature that the me, the sense of me, you know, is not doing anything. You simply are. You're not becoming. You're not knowing. Like it's a nice day, now I get to illumine a nice day. Or it's a rainy day, oh, now I'm illumining a rainy day. You're not illumining, you're illumining but not knowing. Because you can use the word like that. It's a nice day, oh, now I'm aware of illumining, so now I'm aware of a nice day. You're not aware of anything except awareness. You are awareness, not awareness of something. You are the me, but not doing anything, you know? You're not me who is aware of something. You're just me. And so this me that you are, what you start to recognize as you analyze your experience, the me, this me, is not a verb. It's not engaged in activity. I simply am. And then everything takes place and shines after. It's called anubhati. Everything shines after me. But I am not a knower of anything. So, for instance, because of Maya, Maya Upadhi, the one that goes into an unmanifest condition and comes out of a manifest condition, when your mind is awake, you know, then it, because of the sattva, sattva, rajas, and tamas of the Maya, every thought that you have, every emotion that you have, means this body mind instrument, every thought that you have, it is known. Every emotion you have, it is known. Not because the me is a knower of it, but because the knownness, the self-evident nature of consciousness, you know, when the thought arises in consciousness, that thought partakes of the knownness of the consciousness. It's the consciousness that is known, and Maya exists, has its being in that consciousness. And so when the vrittis, the thoughts, come into manifestation, they enjoy the knownness of your being. But your being as just conscious being is always conscious being, but it's only but it only is self-evident. Even this is misnomer, but I was going to say, it's only self-evident to itself. That's a problem, because then that's as though this me is somehow divides itself up and is aware of itself. That's not right. It's that because me, this me, is conscious being, it is its own experience of conscious being. Conscious being doesn't need another consciousness to give it the experience of being known. It is the experience of being known without subject-object relationship. The knownness is the self-evident nature of consciousness. And so this me that I am is always exactly the same, is always self-evident, because it is consciousness. And so Swamiji will kind of joke and say, it is always awake, because consciousness, by its very nature, is its own self-evident experience. So now, say you're contemplating, you're meditating, and you're just kind of relaxing so that the body is not calling any attention to itself. You're relaxing your mind so it's also not a problem for you. It's not tension, or it's not calling attention to itself. You know? And then you just let the mind gently, this is some guided meditations we do, you just let the mind gently focus on your own being. Now, That's not that the mind has its own awareness and is focusing, and it is, you know, the awareness that's now looking at you, like here I am, and now the mind is its own eye looking at you. It's not that, even though that's why the language can be confusing. But what is happening is that your mind can be directed outward. See, the mind through the sense organs, the mind is directed outward. Okay? Then the mind is filled with the content of the room, for instance. My eyes are open. The mind is directed, utilizing my eyes. I'm getting a thought modification. I'm getting a thought modification of the room. That is known. Any thought modification is known just by the mere fact that it's there, because it takes place in consciousness. It takes place in knownness, the knownness of consciousness. And so whatever the vritti, thought modification is, that is known. Right? Now what if the mind, instead of looking out through the eyes or the sense organs, it's directing its attention toward the one that's illumining it, the knownness itself? Then the mind doesn't have any type of any object filling it. It's as though erasing itself. It's still there as the sattva, but it has no content other than the conscious being, which is its very being, in fact. And so now the experience is that yourself is now pervading the mind or becoming dominant in the mind. That's true from the standpoint of the mind, because the mind has changed its direction from outward to inward, so to speak. And in doing that, it's as though my being is filling the mind, because it's not filled with anything else. But actually my being is not filling the mind any more than it was before. It's just that the direction of the mind, instead of being a mirror turning outward, it's more of a mirror turning inward. Nothing is really happening to consciousness. But the knownness of me, the self-evident nature of me, is going to be enjoyed equally by any and every vritti. Vritti means thought modification. Any and every thought modification, whether it be a perception or an emotion or a fantasy or whatever is going on in the mind, that will be equally, in full measure, enjoying my being, the knownness of my being. So the mind is going through, because it's Maya, it's going through all kinds of different types of states of experience. Sometimes it's affected by rojas. Sometimes it's overwhelmed by tamas. And overwhelmed by tamas means in deep sleep. Goes into unmanifest condition. Say the mind, and this is the parinama upadana karana of Maya. Maya can go into a causal condition. Say the mind goes into a deep sleep, because you have waking, dream, deep sleep. Say it goes into causal condition. Then what is the experience? Well, the experience is that the same knownness, the same meanness, which has never been a knower and will never be a knower, just is self-evident me, is now from the standpoint of the mind, illumining a mind that is in its causal condition. When the mind is in the avyakta, avyakta means this, the nama rupas aren't, names and forms aren't manifest, it's in avyakta, how's the mind going to be commenting on that causal condition? There's nobody there to comment. Right, so the mind is just quiet. It just remains quiet. That's all. There's nobody saying, oh look, I'm deep sleeping. The instant it says that, it's awake. You know. So what happens when the mind is in deep sleep? At that time, the mind is in unmanifest condition. There's no, how to talk about that really, is in the deep sleep, there is no availability of any type of knower known subject-object relationship. One thing that tells you right away is that the knower known relationship depends upon the mind being manifest and the sense organs being available. If they're not available, then subject, object, knower, known, seer, seen is not there. So that cannot be your swarupa. That can't be your nature. And in fact, if you think that's your nature, then it's very hard to understand something like deep sleep, because then that means your being must go into deep sleep. If you go into deep sleep and there's no duality experience, subject-object duality, no knower known, then the knower is going into deep sleep. And if you think that you're the knower, then in deep sleep you must be in a manifest condition, right? But you're not a knower. You're just me, conscious being. And so now, if that's understood, when the mind, which is an unmanifest condition, and so deep sleep, so there's no experience of duality at all, no subject-object, you know, but still awareness, right, is the one that's illumining that deep sleep condition of the sattva mind. The mind stuff is in its causal condition. Now, when the mind comes out of causal condition, right, then the functioning mind and functioning sense organs are there, and then what do you think that the mind has to say about the deep sleep condition? How can it talk about it? It can talk about it because it has a memory of it. It has a memory because it's still a vritti. If the mind goes into unmanifest condition, the mind is still there, but it's in causal condition. When it comes out of causal condition, it will talk about its causal condition. And it'll say, you know, oh, I slept so well, I didn't know anything. You know? If I say, well, what was deep sleep like? Well, I said, you can explain it from when you're awake, but you're explaining an experience that you had in which there was no subject-object relationship to talk about it while you're having that experience. But there is no death experience, there's no lack of me, there's lack of a commentator on me, and also, this is also really kind of critical in terms of your viveka, of the discrimination of your inner experience, there is a big difference between the mind going into its causal condition, which is just, we would say, you know, like in the Mandukya, pure ajnanam. It's just pure ignorance. Right? It's pure ajnanam because the maya, from the standpoint of the jiva, when it's in a manifest condition, is just ajnanam. It's like just a big, I don't know anything, because there's nobody there. There's no faculties there to participate in a know or known relationship. So now me, self-luminous me, is illumining pure ajnanam. Pure ignorance, you know, and that causal condition where there's no name and form, you just call it pure ignorance, that's what's being illumined. And nobody's commenting back. So when the mind becomes manifest again, then there's a commentator of that condition that it had just had. Oh, I had such a deep sleep, I didn't even dream. You don't remember that you did anyway, you know? So now, if I look at waking, dream, deep sleep as different states of maya, right, because maya is parinama upadana karana, it's going through all different types of states of experience, whereas yourself is vivarta upadana karana, it goes through no states of experience. It is never vyakta. It is never manifest. It is non-dual conscious being that it never does anything. It never does anything. It just is itself. Right? And itself is, what's the nature of this? It is itself. Is being and knownness. Being which is knownness. Being which is known. Known means consciousness. And so the relationship between these two upadana karanas, one is vivarta, never changes, you know, and one is parinama, what is the relationship between them? You know? Does Brahman, which is being itself, is it the material cause? Is it the material cause of maya? Did Brahman, or we can say like this, did Brahman create maya? Brahman, which is just pure conscious being, which is vivarta, means it never goes through any type of modification to become anything. It has no parts. What is the relationship between Brahman, conscious being, and Maya, the parinama vivarta upadana karana that manifests this whole creation? What is the relationship between the two? Was Maya created? Did Brahman create Maya? Who created Maya? Who could have created Maya? Brahman can't create Maya because Brahman has no parts. It's just pure conscious being. It doesn't have any arms or legs. It doesn't have a mind. All of those things belong to Maya. So Brahman, as the material cause, can't transform into Maya because it has no parts to do that. It's free of time and space itself. Time and space belongs to Maya. And then, so Brahman can't be the cause, so its non-existence has morphed into Maya. And now how can, and who's going to be there to create Maya? And out of what would they create Maya? They'll say nobody created Maya at all. Maya's beginningless. Because who's there to create it? Just like, who's there to create Brahman? How can Brahman be created? It has no parts. You know, it's not objectifiable. It doesn't go through any type of process of manifestation because it has no part. So, does it have a grandfather? I mean, how did it come into being? And what would it come into being from? You know, it would have to be, what would it be that would bring that into being? What would the prior condition of Brahman be? See, if Brahman has no parts, it is just pure conscious being, right? It can't go through any type of modification. So then, how can it become? So he said, it can't become, it simply is. It simply is. It's not like it has a prior condition. It's also, it has no parts, it's free of time, it's not objectifiable. So, we don't even say Brahman is beginningless. Beginningless kind of makes you think of a process. Brahman is beginningless. It's a little different than saying Brahman has always been there. But even if you say Brahman has always been there, it's though it's really old by now, it's been there for a really long time, you know? That's also not right. Because for Brahman, something that is actually non-dual, just now from within itself, it has no parts, you know? It's not objectifiable, but it has no time. So what if you say Brahman is free from time? It's free from any type of objectification because it has no parts to do that. So if it's free from time, then you can't say it's been here for a long time. Or you can't say it's been here from beginningless time. Or that it's always been here. Say it's always been here, it's been here for a really long time. No. We're saying it's free from time. That's what we mean by nitya. Anitya means it's time-bound. It exists within time. Nitya means timeless. So if you say Brahman, as conscious being, as the upadana karana, as the material cause, which is vivarta, it goes through no process of becoming, you know, but it is the material cause. That material cause is always, because it's timeless, always simply is. Free from time, it is. So what would we call that in terms of our experience from within Maya, like this body, mind, sense organs? How would we relate to that in terms of my experience is exactly what my experience is, and that is, I am always in the present. I am never and can never be not in the present. Because I'm even I'm imagining the future, which is in the present, projecting into the future, that's in the present. Or I'm remembering the past. That's in the present. There cannot be any movement whatsoever away from the present. So as Swamiji will say, once we get kind of to this upadanakarana, myself as the very existence, consciousness, existence, which everything enjoys, everything. It is known, it is known, it is known, it is known, my mind is known, my thoughts are known, my emotions are known, my perceptions are known. There's nothing not known. That knownness is the self-evident nature of consciousness. You say it's known, it's known, it's known. But if I say the wall is known, the space is known, this is known, this is known, these clothes are known, my body is known, my sense organs are known, my thoughts are known, my emotions are known, the I thought is known, my things I don't know are known, I know I don't know this, the things that I know I don't know about that, the things that I know are known, I am known, there is nothing but known. There is no knower, everything is known. The knower is just a construct. The knownness is consciousness. There's never anything apart from consciousness, and consciousness is being. You have no experience that doesn't have being. It is, 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 this is, this is, this is, this is, no exception. In your emotions, this emotion is known, it's known, it's known, it's known, this thought is known, it's known, it's known, the I thought is, everything is, everything is known. You never can have an experience free from that. So that is known is the upadana karana that never changes. Vivarta. That is Brahman. I am Brahman. I'm not a knower. I'm the knownness which the whole creation, you know, the whole creation enjoys. And that is knownness is free of time. So you imagine now that within time, you have an experience of the present, like this present moment. Actually, this present moment is infinitely divisible. You know, it's like taking a bunch of rose petals and putting them together and putting them, you know, like a pin through them. The pin goes through like that, one petal at a time. So you can never find the present, but let's just pretend like we can. This moment is the present. It's made up of a billion, infinite number of presents. But anyway, this moment is present, and then who and what am I? Say, I am, Swamiji will say, I'm the presence of the present. Mm-hmm. Of any given perception, of any given moment of time, even though that can go into an infinite regress, you can never find the moment. It's always me. But whatever the moment is, whatever you think it is, I am the presence of that present. And there's no veering away from that. That's what we mean, vivarta upadana karna, because I am the self of everything, without any exception, but I never change to become that. For the whole maya, which is responsible for seeing, and this whole display of all of the jivas, and the whole display of the creation, I am, as Brahman, I am its self, because the whole maya is, and it is known. The isness and its knownness is me, is conscious being. But the maya is coming into being, going out of being continually. It's continually changing, continually subject to birth, death, modification. But it has no being of its own because there's nothing in the maya that doesn't come into being and go out of being. From beginningless time, you can also can't find a beginning to that because there's nothing from which it can come. Right?
Could you say that again?
There's no beginning to maya because there's no prior condition. You can't get to a prior condition. What did maya come from? Because maya includes all time, space, objectivity, all exists within maya. So what is its beginning? From what? So everything about maya is kind of like chicken and egg, even when you go into from causal to manifest to causal to manifest. That's a cycle. But when did that cycle begin? Because the cycle is interdependent, and the cause this is all gets into that Mandukya Upanishad. Yeah. And so with all of this is the one verse in the Mundaka, not Mandukya, but the Mundaka Upanishad that is making you kind of recognize and differentiate in terms of your experience the awakeness, the Swamiji will say, of your own being as just conscious being. So he means just conscious being. It never changes. It never goes to sleep. All experiences depend upon that for their knownness and their beingness. That's the Vivarta Upadana Karana, which is my own self. And then the whole display of Maya, whether on an individual level or on a total level, depends totally on me for its knownness and its beingness. That's why Vivarta Upadana Karana, you can't pull consciousness and existence away from the creation and have it be there. That's why they use the rope snake analogy in the clay pot. So you take the, you can't pull the clay out of the pot and have the pot still be there. So imagine pulling being or existence out of the creation and having the creation still be there. You've just taken away its being, its existence. It can't be there. Now it's just non-existence. And you can't say that it's non-existence in and of its own accord. You know, the creation is here, but it doesn't exist, really. Only I exist, really. If you say that, if you're saying that the creation doesn't exist, you've pulled the existence out of it, there would be no creation. Because it doesn't exist. If you analyze the creation down to its core, and you say down at the core of it is non-existence. No. At the core of it is me. Right? Being itself. And that's how you experience the creation. It is, it is, it is, it is. Being is superimposed on it. It has me for its being. Time and space have me for its being, but I have nothing to do with time and space. So think of your imagination. If you imagine, what if I ask you to, well, imagine the night sky, because I like to do that when I'm at the farm. I like to look up at the night sky, so I'll just imagine the night sky. So you, now you have an imagination of this night, this beautiful, huge night sky. Have you become huge? There is no becoming huge or small for you because you're free of time and space. Time and space belongs to Maya. And Maya has no being outside of consciousness, conscious being. So it's totally irrelevant how large or small the Maya manifestation is, because in reference to it has no being apart from the self, and the self has no size. It's outside of it. It doesn't deal in dimension. It's free of time and space. Time and space belongs to Maya. That's why you can have big thoughts and little thoughts. And big imaginations and little tiny imaginations. It doesn't make any difference. It's all totally relative. Nothing is happening to you. You don't become tiny and you don't become big. And that is your experience. When you think of me, just me, your own being, tiny, big, small, tall, these don't apply. Dimension doesn't apply to you. Non-duality applies to you, that there is nothing else. But when there's nothing else, big or small or tall or high, these things don't apply. So these words just fall off. They're irrelevant. They don't fit the situation. Even now, what you can do is when you're just sitting with yourself and just focusing on your own me experience, that's very self-evident me, you know, right now, you can say, there's nothing away from me, and yet I have no dimension. I'm not big like the room. Say, this is a big room, say. I'm not big like the room, and I'm not small either. But the room is not away from me. You can just imagine, just focus on your own presence, your own me. So that's self-evident. And then with your sense organs, be present to the room, have the thought modification of the room. What is the relationship between your own presence in terms of dimension, all of this, and the room? You're not a little pea in the pod. You're the me is not a little pea in the pod of the body, you know? Like there you are, little me inside the body. There's no little me and there's no big me. there's this room and there's me that is really not contained and has no size. So you have to just sit with your experience and recognize. Sometimes I say put this me in the middle of the room. Just don't let it be stuck in the body, because that's just an imagination that it's stuck in the body. It's not stuck anywhere. It is not. It doesn't have to do with dimension. Do you see what I mean? So that's a good meditation to focus on, even with your eyes open, just to focus on your own presence, just this me, and then see where it's located in terms of this. It's not located in the body. It's not located anywhere. All of this is located in it, so to speak. But it's your me. It's not big or small. It's not over there. It's not over there. It's not over there. If anything, it's central to the entire experience, and it has no dimension. So these are meditations. Now I can give the meditation. I figured out how to give this. But I think we needed this talk first before we can do it next time. Okay. That's it. What time is it? No. Okay. Well, that was a good satsang. Yeah. Enjoyed all your questions.
Om swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishah go brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam Loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varishatu parajanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yam kshobarahitah vamana santu nirbhayah om sarve bhavantu sukhinah sarve santu niramayah Sarve bhadrani pashyantu ma kaschit dukkabhag bhavet asato ma sadgamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityor ma amritam gamaya om purnamadah purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om
Brahman does not pin on anything. Brahman is
right.
Where is Maya is dependent for its existence
on Brahman.
However, this Maya, the order of the universe, and take the body, the human body, and how it works, and all the small, minute details of how it.
Everything, all of that.
There's got to be some sort of intelligence going on.
Yeah, what Swamiji will say is Maya, and when it's manifest, it's infinite intelligence. Okay. It's infinite knowledge. It would never, the infinite order. So it's not like it's just, like when you think of your little imagination, you think of the limitations of your own intelligence, and you couldn't even have it. I mean, even that you get to have an imagination is something way beyond anything we could imagine doing ourselves. Right? So it's not about intelligence or infinite order, or infinite manifest knowledge going, infinite manifest knowledge going into infinite unmanifest knowledge like that. But all of that is what we call Maya. So you can look at it as the mind, infinite mind, infinite intelligence of consciousness, if you want to talk like that. It's like the whole creation is the manifestation of infinite knowledge.
But its status as not being either real or unreal is mind-boggling in a way, right?
Yes, because if it was unreal, it wouldn't be here. That's right. What we call teaching.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If it was real, what we mean by real is simply that it doesn't fit that definition. So when we say sat or satyam, if you define satyam as translated as real, that can be psychologically misleading for how we use the word real, because the other is false then. But what we mean by sat is that which can never be negated in past, present, or future. That means it has never come into being, it can never go out of being, it is free of time. Because anything that is not defined in that way is bordered by non-existence. Anything subject to change, it has a prior condition, a posterior condition of non-existence, of non-being. And we mean non-being not like shunyata. We mean literally what we call tucham. It is not there. It's not that something is coming out of emptiness. We would call emptiness as existence without nama-rupa. You know? And so then, but we would bring in Maya, so it's a little different than how the Buddhists talk about this. Even though I think they're talking in around exactly the same thing, actually. But with Maya has no essence at all. It has essence. Its essence is Brahman. That's what we say, adhishtana. Brahman is the adhishtana, which means what the Maya, the subject that Maya depends upon to be.
But I think the thing is that it isn't caused. It's uncaused.
Uncaused.
So that makes it also, it makes its status very tricky, right? Because Brahman hasn't caused it, because Brahman doesn't do anything.
But Brahman is also uncaused.
Right, that's true.
Yeah, Brahman is uncaused, and Maya is intrinsic to Brahman, just not dual, just as no independent being. You don't have any place to put Maya except in Brahman, because there's nothing but Brahman. And so we say that Maya belongs to Brahman, it's intrinsic to Brahman, but not in a dual way. It's like you can't, where are you going to put the pot? The pot has to be put in the clay, but even though there's no pot. But since the pot is experienced, where are you going to put it, outside of the clay? The pot has to belong to the clay, but it doesn't belong to the clay, really. Right? So we say it's an incidental attribute. The pot is an incidental attribute of the clay. Incidental because it doesn't do anything to the clay. This is called Tattvastha Lakshana. This is Swamiji's translation. There's two lakshanas, two ways of defining something. One is Swarupa Lakshana, one is Tattvastha. Swarupa Lakshana, like for instance for Brahman, the Swarupa Lakshana would be what defined the definition that is true to its actual nature, which would be Satchit Ananda. Right? The Tattvastha Lakshana is something which points to Brahman but does not bring about any change to Brahman. The whole Maya, the whole creation, the manifest coming into consciousness, coming into manifestation, going out of manifestation is Tattvastha Lakshana because it's not away from Brahman. Swamiji calls that incidental attribute. In the world, an example we use for it is, he uses his own town, whereas, you know, in Manjikuti, if you look down a road, all the houses are exactly the same. Same color, same everything. Except one of the houses, he wants to point out his house way down at the end. You know, somebody, some friend is pointing out, because Swamiji's house is different, actually. But, but if you go look all the way down, they're all exactly the same. But look, my house is the one that has the crow sitting there on top of the chimney. Do you see that one? And it's the only house that has the crow sitting on top of the chimney. And so that crow becomes useful, right? And so we say Maya is an incidental attribute because it only belongs to Brahman without bringing about any change whatsoever to Brahman. You can't put it anywhere else. So since Maya is taking place, is not away from Brahman, it's kind of like the crow sitting on the... You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it can't do anything to Brahman.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, that's where it is. And it has Brahman for its very being, adhishtana.
You're talking about the whole perceivable universe.
Yeah, the crow. and the whole perceivable universe on every single level that can only be placed in Brahman. You know, because the very satchit that in the joyous is only Brahman, and you can sure it has no satchit of its own, conscious being of its own. It, you know, it's impossible to give satchit, conscious being, to it, because you can't even find it. If you're analyzing it, you can't find it. Mm-hmm. It's infinitely divisible, time-wise. You know, you can't even find the beginning to it. And the time, and you can't find a present, you can't find a beginning. You know, everything is goes into an infinite, every part of it goes into an infinite regress.
So then what's this Swarupa?
Swarupa is its own nature. So the nature of Brahman would be Satchit Ananda. It is existence, which is consciousness, which is limitless. That's pointing to the nature of Brahman itself. The Swarupa of the house would be, you know, it's a brown with a chimney and a wooden door, and or you're actually just pointing to the characteristics of the house.
You know, I was wondering, this equating the consciousness to your own presence.
Yeah,
that really works for me. But what I was curious about is there any sensation about consciousness or any sensation about...
Well, if you want to use a word like sensation...
Yeah, or...
Or feeling or something like that.
Uh-huh.
You can... Those words are problematic because when we think about sensations, we're thinking about things that come and go.
No, I'm not...
But when you're talking about... If you use a word like feeling, especially, maybe more than sensation... It's a feeling or a sensation that is not objectifiable and not subject to change. The reason you want to use those words is because you don't want it to be, you want it to be you, not like neutral, unconscious space.
Right.
But you're not used to thinking of consciousness as not a knower either.
Mm-hmm. But it seems like meanness should have something to it.
It does. But then you have to sit in contemplation and say, what is the me landing on? What experience is me landing on? We're not talking about the thoughts and feelings and emotions that come and go or the objectifiable changing experiences.
No.
What about the me for whom all those experiences are?
Right.
So kind of like Ramana was always trying to make you follow your I thought back to where it lands. You have to do that. Where does it land? And then, for some, I don't know why it's like this, but it is always landing on you, but at least in my own process, it was something like, it's not that I said this or anything, but when I realized it, it was like I was saying this. They can't mean me. When they're talking about Brahman, it couldn't be, because when I say me, it's landing on me. And they certainly couldn't mean that. Mm-hmm. And so then, at some point, you realize, oh my gosh, that's exactly what they mean. They actually mean me, the me that is me. And then once that clicks, that's a huge click. And then you start to see, well, can I get rid of that? Is that a thought? Is that an experience? Is that something that I can shake in some way or have an experience without that? And then you realize, no, you can't. And is it a knower? Am I a knower? No, I just am. I'm self-evident me. And then, say, if you do japa, japa is very powerful for this, the repetition of a mantra. Because what happens is you repeat the mantra. It goes from mantra, like Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya. So mantra, silence, mantra, silence. If you've done that for a while, then there's a shift that takes place where the mantra is rising and setting in silence. The silence is stable. And then your mind can, you can ask your mind, the mind can ask a question. Am I, the me, doing anything to know the mantra? Am I doing anything? What is my relationship to the mantra? realize the mantra is taking place in me, but I'm not, and it is known, the mantra is taking place in me, and it is known, but I'm not doing anything to know it. I'm not a knower. So japa is very powerful for making me recognize that everything is known, but I'm not the knower. Well, every experience is known, but I'm not the knower. I'm not knowing it. It just is known because of me.
But when I say it like shantavam, I can see sort of an absolute peace. And what I'm trying to do is, I know it's not a sensation and it's not a feeling, but it's something, isn't it?
Yeah, it's your own being. Your being is not nothing, you know. So say you recognize that shanti, that peace. Then what you need to, the next step for that is to notice that shanti or that meanness is not disturbed by vritti. You can have any type of thought modification, worry, whatever it is.
Mm.
It doesn't touch that shanti. Otherwise, you're looking at the shanti as a type of thought modification.
Yeah, yeah.
So that jump has to take place where you recognize that no matter what you're thinking, no matter what you're feeling, that silent me remains untouched and always ever present. And it's not improved upon by your quiet mind. And it's not hurt by your hurt mind. Even though you prefer to have a quiet, beautiful mind, and you would rather not have the hurt mind, but your self is not changed positively or negatively by either one. And that's the moksha. Moksha is the recognition of the free self. And then an added benefit is that as the mind recognizes and differentiates yourself, it relaxes because now it's not threatened anymore. Because your being is no longer threatened, and so the mind relaxes. And the ananda and the happiness and all of that, you no longer try to make the world give it to you. As though it has it to give. It does not have it to give.
But see, that's a challenging moment when there's a pain or a hurt. It's overwhelming. And then that sense of peace is...
But when the mind is hurt and all that is happening, that's why we have all of these sadhanas for how to be with the mind. It's like you don't question the sadhanas you have for how to be with the body if the body is hurt or if it's burnt or you broke your arm or sprained your leg or you have some illness or whatever. Then you bring in the appropriate sadhanas to take care of that.
Yeah.
And there's also appropriate sadhanas, especially in the light of this knowledge, to take care of the reacting mind and take care of the unconscious and these type of things. And then your self-knowledge and knowledge of Ishwara takes care of the topical problems of how to be in the world, how to be with Jiva, the relationship between the Jiva and Ishwara. There's a tremendous relaxation that takes place through that knowledge, but there's also, you have to know how to handle your hurts and pains and complexes in a way that, which is included in this knowledge, you know, in a way that's also very on a very psychological level, in a way that takes care of our reactions and emotions and things like that. You have to know how to be, that's all part of the teaching too.
It can almost be harder in a way when you're, because of the knowledge, you're very aware logically that this thing in the world isn't going to make you happy, but you feel it so strongly that it will, that it's almost, like upsets, or speaking for myself, it almost upsets me more because I see through it, but I can't stop it from happening, you know?
You know, what one good way to understand that, though, is when there's a level of understanding in terms of karma yoga. And that is, you know, you will as a jiva, whether you are jnani, have jnana nishtha, and you're really rooted in this knowledge, you know, or not, you will still have desires. Because the prarabdha karma, one of the things that pushes you through your life, is other people are either pulling you into it, you know, the universe is shifting in such a way that it's just happening around you and there you are, or it comes from within as in the form of a desire, you know? And so there's that. So it's not that desires disappear. And there's this also, well, these people seem happy. Maybe if I did what they're doing, I would be happy also. Those things we pick up along the way. So with a karma yoga attitude, we say like this, as long as the desire is not adharmic, because then now that's something different, you know? I love alcohol, and yes, I'm an alcoholic, but I want to keep drinking, that kind of thing. It's not helpful. You know, you're hurting yourself. But say it's dharmic, there's nothing wrong, it's not hurting you, it's not hurting others. You know? Then you would say, then you go for it, accepting the results of your actions as prasad, with a prasada buddhi. And then it's fine. That's bitter. Say you have a strong desire to try, instead of trying to swallow it, there's nothing wrong with the desire. Try to fulfill the desire, accepting the results with that as that prasada buddhi. Then you're in relationship with Ishvara, you know, and you're not trying to put a damper on yourself. And you're also releasing, you're allowing your mind to have shanti while you're fulfilling that desire. It's karma yoga. There comes a time when those desires don't have maybe the force that they did. They can kind of drop off, and then it's kind of like just whatever is coming up for you to be done, that's what you do, and you take not for really the karma pola, the result of the action, it's just because that's your duty. That's what's here to be done right now. That's what Bhagavan is asking you right now. You're going to have to talk in that language. This is what Bhagavan is asking. This is what is here for me to do. And I don't even care about desire anymore. But if you care about this, if there is a desire that seems really meaningful, then you should try to fulfill it and just see what Bhagavan does. Accept it with that prasada buddhi. And then if it doesn't get fulfilled and you still have it, then try it a different way. And then see what Bhagavan does and accept it with that as prasada. Then you're fine.
But it's like that attitudinal, like if you're pursuing a desire, there's some part of you that thinks that you're going to be fulfilled once you have that desire.
If you really think that you're going to be fulfilled, you know, then you'll find out that that's not true.
Yeah.
but there might be a lot of prarabdha involved in fulfilling that desire, something you really want to do. I wouldn't try to throttle it if it's not adharmic. Because that's kind of the juice also of your life. Why do you have energy to do this? So if you have really energy to do it, you want to do it, then why should you not do it? What, are you going to wait to do something that you don't want to do? It's better to do something that you do want to do and accept the results as Ishvara, you know, the prasada buddhi. It gives you the freedom actually to do things. That's called dugdha bija. Those are desires that are like burnt seeds. They'll cause a problem for you because of your relationship with the pola. You don't see yourself as in Sanskrit we call the karma pola dhatta, the one as the giver of the fruits of the action. There's so many variables involved in anything you do, way more than your action. You know, so many other things that come in. So you all take it always as Ishvara. That becomes natural at the time. But it's not necessary to think, I have to veer off from all desires. I shouldn't have any desires. You can't even get up and get a drink of water. You know? You have to live your life. The thing is, can you live your life with a certain freedom? Which means that if I don't get this, I'm fine. If I get it, I'm fine. If I don't get it, I'm fine. I accept. Or if I feel I'm not fine, I'll try to get it in another way. I still have that prasada buddhi. You know?
So there's no jiva. It sounds like the jiva's not creating a life or for himself or anything in that respect.
Well, in reality, you may think that you're creating the life as though that this is kind of an inert creation and you're just carving out a life for yourself, but actually you are living your life, the life that's unfolding for you. And you have free will within that. But it's not like you're the creator of your life. Your karmas that are manifesting create the life. So the more you start to understand that, the more you can kind of enjoy your life and watch the universe, be part of the universe, the unfolding of the universe. You know, and then enjoy your place here. Do you realize you have a place? Like in the dream, for instance, the dream character can think whatever he or she wants. But actually, she's part of a whole story that's going on there. So you can enjoy being a part of the story, and it's not like you have no free will. The free will is like a muscle that you can utilize, but only a little bit. It's not like you have free reign, because you're already stuck in the situation that limits your freedom, right? The entirety of the situation that you find yourself in only gives you so many options.
Right? So if that situation is a kind of alcoholic, like a dharmic compulsive thing, the whole dream is doing that story, then we have that to work with then, just however we can.
Yeah, you're stuck working with it and getting out of it. You want to pull out of it because it's toxic. It's not in your best interest. And yet you find that you can't get out of it. It's a big struggle. But that becomes your struggle. You know, the struggle is not to go deeper and deeper into the alcohol until it kills you. It's to somehow get out of it. It can be some struggles are very, very challenging. Who knows? I mean, who knows what the karmas are that bring you into a life where you're surrounded with alcohol or alcoholics, or say you're brought into a life where you're surrounded with drug users. Say your parents are all potheads, and you're born into that.
That's just an example, but like desires in general, you know, or aversion, maybe.
Yeah, but the desires are going to be there. The problem is, there's desires that first thing level is. Are the desires dharmic or adharmic? Desires by themselves are not dharmic or adharmic. Just because they're a desire doesn't make them adharmic.
Mm-hmm.
But if the desire, there's no harm in the desire, you know, then the only harm is the desire template that says, I have to have this so that I can be happy. And that's the harm, not the desire. The desire can be very benign. Because you're fine if you get it and fine if you don't. Even though you have a preference, but if you don't get it, that's fine. That's a benign desire. If you have that prasada buddhi, there's a desire, you fulfill that desire, and you take results from the Lord, then that's fine, it's not a problem. But if your ananda or your well-being is dependent upon how that desire turns out, that's highly stressful. And then if you fulfill the desire and you only get the ananda that you were seeking for a few seconds or a minute, so quickly replaced. You have the thing, but the happiness that you were thinking you would get from it less than a minute usually. So it's shocking. Mm. So you start to see through all that.
Did your understanding that you had to learn. You had to gain knowledge about Ishwara for that to come more into your life.
I had to gain knowledge about all of it.
Yeah, well, did knowledge of the self seems to be like instantaneous and you can just see the truth of it. But the knowledge of Ishwara seems to be something that grows for it to come into you?
Yeah, it does grow.
What?
It takes a lot of understanding. Because this is all dual. Here I am. This body, mind, sense organs that I'm identified with, in the middle of this whole creation. So how do I go from me being the conscious being in an inert creation to the whole infinite creation being in me?
Yeah.
you know, and this body, mind, sense organs belonging to something greater than itself, that requires a lot of teaching, a lot of understanding, a lot of seeing, you know.
Well, did you see a progress in that appreciation?
Mm-hmm. I saw progress, even a lot of progress in recognizing my own self. I used to always kind of think that I was the Shantavati. Now, you know, like, now my mind is quiet and I recognize myself in the Shantavritti. And then the Shantavritti would go away and then I'd wait for the next Shantavritti.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know. Because there's something that has to happen that releases you from these states of experiences to recognizing yourself, the self-evident being of yourself that never comes and goes. So that was all different layers of understanding. It takes some time.
But Ishwara's, knowledge of Ishwara is a little bit different than that, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And also you come into this life where as the life unfolds, you can come into this birth as kind of a person that already has a relationship with Ishwara. As you know? Or you can come into this life without any type of Shraddha in Ishwara. If you come with Shraddha, you already have Shraddha with Ishwara, you already have that relationship, even though you don't know what it is exactly, but still you believe. And that there's a relationship there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then when you gain knowledge, then you really understand that relationship more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And it just becomes strengthened then. But say, because of things that happened in your past and whatnot, that you don't even like God. You just think he's kind of a jerk. And he's kind of like, you know, whoever he is, I don't even want to know him. You know?
Yeah.
So then you're coming in with kind of a different attitude, and the whole... There has to be a huge reframe. There has to be, if you're coming from the West, there's quite a reframe anyway, but it can be, the reframe can be full, that the thing that has to be reframed can be full of a lot of hurt and negativity and dismissal. You know, and so that's a little bit more of a task mm-hmm. to go from that to mm-hmm. to the whole universe as being a conscious being of which you are a part.
Yeah.
Because there's already a lot of hostility toward God. I got out of that when I was about 13 with a prayer saying, because I was brought up as a Methodist. And I remember the prayer, so it went something like this, a very serious prayer. It said, I just don't believe God is like this. I'm sorry. But I'm wrong. I'm sorry. Can you forgive me if I'm wrong?
I've always had a problem when, you know, you can commit these sins during the week, but as long as you confess them.
Yeah, so some things you just doesn't go along. You don't go along with it. You know, and I didn't go along with that particular God image, but I believed in God. I did believe there was a God, but not like that. So it's a very serious, scary prayer. Because what if God was like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's why I had to apologize as part of the prayer. It was a serious apology. But it wasn't a dismissal of God. It was a dismissal of that type of a God.
Right.
Yeah. We probably weren't Christians or Westerners in our last birth. And this, it's kind of shocking, isn't it, for a God like this, if you just... Have you used a different kind of God?
Punitive God.
Yeah.
But you could also just have no
inclination at all. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But then
and
that's
maybe people try and impose it on you.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's some negativity from that. But
More like an agnostic. That's much easier. Agnostic means you don't know one way or the other. You don't even care that much.
Well, like for me, I would say it's not that I didn't care, but I didn't see how people could assume.
Yeah.
And I still have issues with it.
Yeah, that's a type of agnosticism, which is good because actually you're correct in that
or the means of knowledge you have available to you, you can't make that jump. There's no way to go from your means of knowledge to that. You know, but then some people come in with a lot of samskaras where that belief is just kind of innate, it's just kind of there. And even though you can't prove it or anything, still that belief is there. Another person can say, I can't prove it, and so how can I believe it? Another person says, I know I can't prove it, but I still believe in it. There's just a lot of variables.
Then where's the atheist come in?
The atheist is ignorant, as in a way, says, there is no God. But they have no way to prove that there is no God.
But the agnostic just says, I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah. And how, but it could say, I don't know, and the agnostic can also, I don't know, and how do you think you can know? What are your means of knowledge to know? But somebody who comes in with that shraddha, they know, they believe, but they also know that they don't have any way of knowing, so it's kind of like an intuitive belief, intuitive shraddha, you know, but they can't prove it. That's and if they say they can prove it, then that's really becomes problematic because they actually can't. But they can say, it doesn't matter if I can prove it or not, it's just what I believe, what I feel would be true.
Someone would say, well, this text, like in the West, it would be the Bible usually says so.
They could say that, well, the Bible says so, but you can always say, you don't have to believe in the Bible either. I didn't believe in the Bible.
Not only that, the Bible always seems to be subject to anybody's interpretation.
There are people who do believe in the Bible.
Yeah.
But that's even though it's in the sense that it doesn't prove anything really about God or not God, but it speaks to them. That those myths speak to them and are sacred to them. Well, for another person, it isn't. Let's stop.